By the way, you can interrupt us if we're going long. I know that's not a common practice, but if you have a question, we can take them as I'm going through. It's a pleasure to be here. I'll just explain briefly who I am and what I do. I'm Danish, but I was born in England, so that's why I sound a bit English, and I studied at Cambridge. Crystal balls could be very useful as tools if you're actually working with the future, because it's often very difficult to know what's happening even 2 years ahead. So I spent now, as I'm fairly elderly, only 50% of my time at DR, which is about 20 or 30 hours a week on strategic projects, and I'll mention one or two of these. So I've been working for quite a while on standardization issues, trying to get metadata-driven services like hard disk recorders, the replacements for VCRs, up and running, and that's taken about 7 years. I'm currently working on a project called DTV for All, which is a strategic project for 27 European countries to promote the take-up of access services in connection with digital television. And I'm also involved in a small project with a budget of about 15 million Hong Kong dollars here, looking at rich media on mobile phones, in particular the implications of not just 3G or 3.5G, but other kinds of broadcast media to handheld devices. I teach at a number of universities. This is one of the ones that I really enjoy teaching at, but I'm a lecturer at the University of IT University of Copenhagen and the Danish Technical University, and I've been a visiting fellow at a number of different places in the last few years. I actually work a little bit as an independent, and I work on media policy and strategy in Ireland, for example, and I spend several times a year working on applications for seed capital from games companies and from companies working on video on demand. So I have a fairly broad range of interests, and what characterizes it is convergence and content. But if we go back to the whole business of e-inclusiveness, it sounds very much like a buzzword, a word which is devoid of meaning, but hopefully I can show that it isn't necessarily just a word used by politicians, but something that can in fact be useful for us. One could say, what is the problem? Look at the photographs. Can you actually see anything particular about, or maybe you can spot something about this person, but can you see something to do with this person or some of the others? On the face of it, we've just got a number of people who, they're all human beings, but some of them share commonalities and others difference. We've got a diverse group of people, a diverse group of cultures. But we may be diverse in other ways too. So if we look at some of these people, they may have hearing impairments. They may not find it quite as easy to understand what we're saying as people with normal hearing. There may be those with some kind of visual impairment. I mean, those of us who have passed the age of 50 find it difficult to change our point of sight from looking close to far without having some reading glasses or something of that kind. So there may be minor visual impairments, or there may be more dramatic ones, people who can barely see the difference between light and dark. And there may be others with different kinds of impairments, not just being able to get around, but perhaps some kind of intellectual impairment, and not being able to remember the names of things, or finding it difficult to understand what's being said, not because of their hearing, but for other reasons. And the mobility one, which seems to have been dealt with very well in Hong Kong, many places have got very good mobility access for those in wheelchairs. But in most societies, what we can say is that there are those for whom certain services are not fully accessible, not without our doing something about it. But they may be not accessible at all without some sort of help. It's a bit like going to the reception and pressing the bell to get some sort of attention, somebody to help. And there may be those who don't get the full benefit out of IT systems, they need some kind of help. The interesting thing, if you're a politician, is how big is this number? And again, there's the issue of is our lack of awareness of the fact that people may find certain things difficult and other things not so difficult. In fact, a problem that the rest of us face. We've already seen over the last 30 years that IT has helped in, for example, television. So we've had things called closed captioning. We've got induction loops to make it easier for people to hear all kinds of services. On television, we've got open captioning, which is something which is forced. So that's where everybody is forced to see subtitles. It's also called texting from the hard of hearing, or we may be able to increase the size of the captions on the television set or television screens or on computers or other devices. We can do something about making remote controls better. We can use Braille for those who choose to read, those who are blind and need a different way of accessing the written word. And if there are Braille mobile phones, for example, or signing. Sign language is important for people with certain kinds of hearing disabilities and, in fact, intellectual disabilities. Those with visual impairments may actually benefit from audio description, which is a kind of additional descriptive audio channel explaining what's going on for DVDs, for example, for other things. Then there's the beginnings of new services which take text and use speech synthesis. So, for example, starting January, you can buy television sets in the UK which have a speech synthesis chip built in, certainly for English, not for Welsh to begin with, and that allows blind people and others to actually read the program guides and other kinds of text on the screen. It would just be read aloud for them. So what we can see is that we've got a number of options. We can actually do something to make things more accessible, but I'd like to look at this term e-inclusiveness. What does it actually mean? We could look at it from the angle of a product being acceptable, and in general terms we can say, is it from practical, something we can accept from a practical point of view, or is it something which is socially acceptable? I mean, pornography is an example of something which might be practical, but it's not necessarily socially acceptable. Spending 3 hours on a computer game is might be socially acceptable for young people, but wouldn't necessarily be acceptable if your parents are waiting for you to come home and have a meal with the family. So if you look at the practical aspects, we've got these kinds of dimensions: usefulness, cost, reliability, enjoyability. And normally we look in terms of usability and utility, but there's this dimension of accessibility. What does that encompass? And typically, when it comes to IT systems, there seem to be and there are these other dimensions to usability: easy to learn, easy to remember, efficient to use, error-free, and fun to use. But if we're talking about accessibility, we might actually look at what does this actually encompass. Locomotion in this particular context is being able to move. We saw people who get around in wheelchairs, but others may have very limited movements, or that they would need, if they stand up, they're not steady on their feet, and they need to be able to use some kind of support to move around, even within the home. Then there's the issue of reach and stretch. I mean, can you actually lift your arm? For example, if you need to be able to use a computer, you may need to use some sort of device, an input device or a remote control. For some people, actually lifting an arm is in fact a problem. I'll quantify that in a minute. And dexterity is actually being able to use your fingers to be able to press buttons. Vision, that's self-explanatory, as is hearing. Communication, can you actually make sense of what's being said? In Denmark, at least, young people tend to use slang. They may just tend to speak rather fast. So elderly people may find it difficult to understand the conventions that young people use and the speed at which they speak. So communication is a sort of an umbrella for a number of different kinds of problems. And then you may have intellectual disabilities, things like Parkinson's, or problems with memory, other kinds of mental disabilities that can have an impact. So when it comes to accessibility, we're looking at what does it take to make what we're doing as accessible as possible to people with these kinds of challenges. Here's a website which is based on two of the largest surveys that I know of to do with impairments and disabilities. It's based on interviews with 7,300 persons over the ages of 16 in the UK, and it's done about every 10 years. The interesting thing about it is the University of Cambridge have put these data sets online, and you can actually work on them interactively to do a simple kind of forecast in terms of how accessible things are, or to say it the other way, if we do certain things, what percentage of the population are we actually excluding by doing so? So it's a very primitive interface, but in a very effective one. I'll just take you through it. So if we, for example, choose locomotion, that's just to be able to move around physically. we've got a sliding scale where we can say, no problems. So at that point, that is not applicable. If we take the first notch on the slide, if we move it forward, you're physically incapable of moving at all the way to being unrestricted movement. So for each of those categories, there is a text explaining that particular thing. So you can actually choose at what point you're going to set it. So I've chosen to take all the people from that point with more severe locomotion difficulties, those who really can't get around, or those who would find it difficult to get over to the television set or over to the computer without being supported. Well, in the UK, what we're talking about is about 1.2 million people in that category. This is the population over 16, and there's 47 million of them. So that's about what 2.7% of the population can't actually get up and walk over to the television set, or can't get up on the unassisted and get over to their computer. If we look at reach and stretch, this one has difficulty raising either arm above the head to reach for something. That's a measure of would you actually be able to lift up your hand and point it at the television with a remote or handle a computer of some kind. And we're talking there about just under a million people. And we can see the two don't add up because there's an overlap. So that's why the total number of people who have both of those difficulties is 1.8 million, or roughly 3.5% of the population. So I've just gone through for dexterity, for vision, for hearing, for communications, and finally I've taken these categories for intellectual functioning. Can't well enough to handle money, can't write a short letter to somebody without help, can't read a short newspaper article, often forgets the name of people in the family or friends seen regularly. Well, on occasion I even do that. Often forgets to turn off things like fires, cookers or taps, can't remember and pass on a message correctly, can't watch a half-hour television program all the way through and tell somebody what it was about. So that's a motley collection of intellectual impairments. It's people who wouldn't necessarily get the full benefit out of a text or something else. And if we tick those boxes there and add them to our collection, what we end up with is this kind of distribution. So we can see that dexterity is in fact quite a big issue on that. It's about 5.5% of the population have some kind of problem just handling things, followed by hearing. I haven't taken people with minor hearing impairments, but significant hearing impairments, that's about 4% of the population. So the total is about 10% of the population would be excluded if we didn't take care of these various things. So if we give an example, which I'll be coming back to, in general terms, if we think about Hong Kong and if everybody just had digital terrestrial television, which started at the end of last year, then if they had to go from having their analog TV onto digital TV, and they had to be able to set it up, because there is in fact a setting up process, roughly 1 in 10 of the population would have to would need some sort of help. They wouldn't be able to do it on their own. And these would be predominantly the people who would be over 65, 70. So it doesn't mean that 10% of the population needs help, but they would probably have to ask a child or a grandchild, if they do have kids, to help them. Or in other cases, they would have to find somebody else to do so. There are parts of the world where there are quite significant schemes to fund the transition from analog to digital, and I'll come back to that. But just to give you an idea, this is a rough and ready way of working out how many people you're excluding. This is online 24/7, for those who are interested, I can give you a copy of this, but it provides you with a general measure of what are the general numbers. So they're not huge, but when you end up with about 10% of the population having some kind of difficulty with, say, setting up a digital television set, that represents a challenge for a society, and it's something we need to look at more carefully at. As usual in the world, we have differences of opinion, and these reflect themselves in different working definitions of what we mean by capacity and impairment. If we look at one of the studies, the most recent study for Hong Kong is about 7 or 8 years old. The global figure for Hong Kong was about 4% who have some kind of disability. If we compare it with the States, it's 19%, and if we take the UK, it's about 17.3%. These two studies were based on very similar methodologies. So for me, I'm surprised that the difference isn't in fact greater. I had assumed that there would have been a bigger difference. What I think explains this is not that Hong Kong is healthier. There's just significant differences in the working definitions. But it doesn't really matter. 4% is still a significant number, and 19% is certainly a significant number. The reference is in the back. The Hong Kong reference. If you look at the footnotes, I'll just find it for you. So it's called Persons with Disabilities and Chronic Diseases, Special Topics Report number 28 from the Census and Statistics Department. That was published in 2001. That's the most recent one I've been able to come across.
So the low concentration of people in small area places that will also increase more people being able to handle this.
Well, if we look at the impairment in terms of the individual, not necessarily their ability to work collectively with these things, I find that number of 4% a little on the low side. I would have thought when you look at there's also a table for comparable figures from other countries, and they tend to vary between about 7 to 17%. So Of course, they've all been used to different working definitions, but I would suspect that it's the figure is lower probably because the definitions are not comparable. I would think, generally speaking, in industrialized societies, we would have broadly the same kind of conditions. I would expect greater obesity in a country like the United States, so other kinds of issues associated with the fact that a bigger proportion of the population is overweight, and you have, for example, indirectly because of that, a bigger proportion of the population with diabetes, and ultimately with sight impairments, which is related to having diabetes for a long term. So, e-inclusiveness, the rationale, why should we bother? Well, we could say that the one thing is something is related to an impairment. So we may have a reduced perception, reduced cognitive powers, reduced abilities to move. But disability isn't directly related with that. So we could say that disabilities are impairments that manifest themselves through deliberate or inadvertent lack of support by others. So you may have a problem, but if you have a supportive society or you have a supportive family, then an impairment won't necessarily manifest itself. It won't necessarily become a problem in your everyday life. So the impairment is the objective cause, but the disability is a societal one. It's something to do with how we relate with those who have different kinds of impairments. And in principle, the number doesn't have to be the same. So we could actually say that in many parts of the world, you have rights, and certainly in Europe, that's at least we could use this particular document to say that we Europeans have the right to be recognized and the document recognizes and respects the rights of persons with disabilities to benefit from measures to decide to ensure their independence, social occupational integration, and participation in the life of the community. It's nice words, but at least there's an ideological commitment to being inclusive. I'm just trying to explain the difference between assistiveness, being assistive, and being inclusive. Here we've got an example of something which is assistive. It looks quite dramatic. It's somebody who's not able to walk unassisted, so there's a kind of robot built around that particular person. It's an extreme example of an assistive technology. Something which is inclusive is a social response. It's something to do with the way in which society has organized itself. And it assumes that we have things in common, but we're also differences, and these may be physical, they may be mental, they may be linguistic backgrounds and so on. But in an inclusive society, we're able to accept that we are in fact different and we can actually benefit from that diversity. Take the example of subtitles. Subtitles shown on, say, the BBC. The BBC is an example of a broadcaster which has subtitles on all of its programs, also its direct programs. And that means that even if you're deaf or hard of hearing, regardless of the time of day, you can actually get some benefit out of watching television. So we can say that's the technology is assistive. Subtitles is an assistive technology. And at the same time, it's inclusive because it's allowing everybody to watch television, or certainly those with hearing impairments. So from that perspective, it's both assistive and inclusive. Here's a second example. This is the news from Northern Ireland. And there's the anchor. And here is, in fact, somebody doing signing, simultaneous translation in sign language. But this is only shown in off-peak hours. It's shown on the net, or it's shown at 3 p.m., but wouldn't be shown in prime-time viewing. So we can say this is an example of something which is assistive and to some degree inclusive. It's not fully inclusive because it's not a service which is available all of the time, only for part of the time. But at least the service is now available on the web, and I in fact took that still from checking it out this morning in my office at the university. And then we can look at some kinds of programs which are just assistive. They don't attempt to be inclusive. If we're rude, we could say ghetto programs for people who are blind. So we're saying we might do a program specifically for the blind and probably do it at marginal times. So in this particular case, there's an example of a program for the blind about going skiing. So this isn't a joke. The blind should be able to live full and meaningful lives, and if they're interested in skiing, there are in fact mechanisms that allow them to ski with somebody else. I didn't realize that until I checked that on out. So when we're talking about the terms assistive, a technology may be assistive, it may help people, but it won't necessarily be inclusive. And we have some interesting examples of that recently. If you go to Portugal and turn on television, even in prime time, you'll see that signing, even on the main news at 9 o'clock. If you do the same thing in the UK or in Denmark, you'll get thousands of complaints from people who will say, why are we being subjective to signing in the main news? There's no difference in technologies. There seems to be a cultural difference between the Danes and the Brits on the one hand and the Portuguese on the other, where the Portuguese society seems to take the whole business of accepting those who have hearing impediments. It's more socially acceptable, it's more broadly acceptable than it is in Denmark and the UK, where we tend to be a little bit intolerant, which in many ways is a worrying phenomenon. Okay, so we could talk about human rights as one of the reasons for doing this, but we can also look at demographics. There are some other arguments for actually looking at inclusiveness, looking at things so that we can both be assistive and also inclusive. The first thing is that the populations are aging. Public health has in fact been a success since the Second World War in places as diverse as Europe and the People's Republic of China. One of the reasons why they have the need to grow so fast is that their public health was successful a lot faster than their economy was growing. So they have actually got first world problems and still a second world economy. So they have many of the challenges you would expect to find in industrialized countries. So populations are aging, and certain problems are age related. So the exclusion problems I listed before, they're fairly widespread among those who are over 70. 25% of those over 75 have at least one of those difficulties I showed you before. But actually, it makes economic sense to ensure the elderly are as independent for as long as possible, because it actually costs either them or their families, or if you have a social welfare state which pays for this out of tax, it costs money to look after the elderly if they're looking longer. So it does in fact make sense to look at measures to help people live rich and full lives as long as possible. Then there's the business case. Depending on the country, there may be mild or there may be quite demanding legal requirements. So there may be regulations. If we take, again, the UK Communications Act has targets for all kinds of broadcasting for those who've got more than 0.5% market share, for things like subtitling, for audio description, that's the audio track for television so that it makes it accessible to people with visual impairments, and for signing. So for companies like the BBC and ITV, they have to provide a 100% subtitling. Audio description, they have to provide at least 10% of their programs with audio description, and signing is about 3-4%. You can see the targets and the compliance with these targets on the Ofcom website, and these are published 3 or 4 times a year. That's probably the most demanding place, but if you take Scandinavia, we're moving in much the same direction. We don't quite have quite the same high targets, but we'll be very at the same sort of level in 2012. Around Europe, you find quite a lot of this. You find regulatory requirements in the US, and you'll also find things in other parts of the world. So the conclusion is that there are quite a lot of legal, ethical, and economic reasons to work towards inclusiveness. It sometimes pays. Take somebody like the people behind Tesco's. They made their website more accessible. They made it, in fact, simpler and started to use some of the W3C guidelines. And it only took a month to have 30,000 more customers actually using their website. And the existing users also said that they found it a lot easier to find their way around the website. So something which is accessible normally is also usable. So it's usability and accessibility tend to go hand in hand. So that was a bit about the problem. There is a problem. I've tried to quantify it. I've given you a tool for actually doing a rough and ready assessment of how big different kinds of access problems might be in a given society. But how can we actually do something about this? How can we be more inclusive? What helps is actually understanding what kinds of problems people actually have, what their causes are, and to evaluate fairly systematically what kind of options you have in the short or medium term. And then also to look at change management. What does it take to get some of these things which are well known and well documented more widely used? People are not stupid. When they don't do something, there's normally a good reason for not doing something. Here we've done something we just did as part of the DTV for All project. We did a simple inventory of typical problems that people might have with television. We've actually tried to calculate how many people might be covered by that kind of problem. So find it difficult or completely impossible to hear the audio of television programs. That's about nearly 2% of the population. That's just people who, it's not people who have got, they simply won't get anything out of it whatsoever. We've got to find it difficult or impossible to hear or understand speech in the mother tongue. So that adds up to around 4% who've got a serious hearing impediment. And then perhaps a few more if you've got sometimes find it difficult to hear and understand speech in the mother tongue. That's not just hearing, maybe when they're speaking fast or using slang. So 6% is already a significant number. If you're interested in audiences, it may make a lot of sense to try and do something about it. I've taken a case which is digital television, and there's a good reason for that, because by 2012, all the countries which are green will be digital, and in 2012, those that are not, the yellow countries will certainly be starting work on it. Africa probably won't be finished until about 2020, and there may be parts of Africa that don't have an active television service at the moment. But what we're seeing is that certainly in the industrialized world, by 2011-12, we'll be finished with analog television. That applies to Hong Kong too. Sometime in 2012, you'll be switching off. So in connection with the transition from analog to digital, the political view of this tends to be that now we're digital, now we've got a lot more flexibility. We can do a lot of things which we couldn't do when things were analog. So their view of the future is just plain sailing, straight ahead, full speed ahead on this road. Our feeling when we look more carefully at it is more like this wood through this road through the woods. We may in fact have some choices. We may have to decide to take that side road a bit further down, and maybe there's a storm and there's a tree blocking the road, and we only realise it when we get a bit closer. Or it might be even worse than that. How about that? I mean, if you suddenly turn around, go around the bend, and you see the blocks of concrete, then you have to realise that there's no way you can continue. You have to stop and go back again.
Certainly, I'm not sure about this point. So, for those impairment figures, even if it's analog, the ones who have no hearing or vision impairment, they still have that problem even with analog.
They have the problem, yes, but the extent to which the technology can help them is more limited. You may have things like teletext or closed captioning with a simple device, but there's a far wider range of options when things are digital than when they're analog. So the political consensus is we've got digital technology. Everybody tells us it's got better quality, more flexible, and so on. It's interactive. So why can't we just do everything? Well, the reality may be more like this. There may be some problems we're not aware of, which we need to look at more carefully. I'm involved in a project I'll be mentioning, which is actually looking at some of these issues, some of the change management issues. And what I can say is that if you speak to different stakeholders, for example, if you speak to the different associations which represent the deaf, they may not necessarily see things the same way. Those who are blind and have visual impairments tend to speak with one voice. Some of the other issues seem to be, if you've got access services, do people actually know they exist? In the UK, it was necessary to do a massive publicity campaign about audio description, after which about 60% of the population knew what audio description was, and about 80% of those who actually had a visual impairment knew what it was about. But that still means that one in five still didn't know of the existence of an assistive technology which could actually help them get more out of watching television. So what we're saying is it's useful to look at the value chain and look at the people in the value chain to get their perspectives on how they see a particular problem, on what they find to be important issues. And then that leads on to another point, which is that any particular service or technology doesn't have an indefinite life. Everything lasts for an increasingly shorter period of time. So we talk about something becoming a sunrise technology, becoming mature, something coming to the end of its useful life, then it becomes a sunset technology. But hopefully, after the sun goes down, the next morning there'll be a new sunrise. And what we see is successive iterations, one technology replacing another. So right now, in terms of digital technologies, when it comes to digital television, we're actually coming to the end of the first generation of digital television, even though it's only just now being introduced in Hong Kong. By 2012, we'll essentially be finished with first generation digital television based on MPEG-2. So there's a technological component. But as a consumer, we'll be going from the pictures we know to bigger, better pictures and with better sound. That's one way of explaining it to those who are not technically inclined. And this means that some of the things we're doing at the moment won't make sense in the future when we move on to the next generation platforms. So examples of the kinds of problems we're grappling with is, this is a signing service. So this is the television channel for people who are watching it normally. Those who want to see signing can switch to a virtual channel which has the signer standing in front of that program. That applies to our channel, our second channel, and in fact our competing channel, which is a commercial broadcaster. All three of them share a virtual television channel which pops up when it's required. There's a coordination so that the three channels don't actually show signing at the same time. And this means that we can actually steal some bits. So normally using about 4.3 megabits for the video. When we're actually doing the signing channel, we only need about 2.5 to 3 megabits. So we steal the bandwidth from the other four channels and shoehorn an extra television channel into the same multiplex. The design of it has got a lot of support from the users. They think it's great. But there are problems. It doesn't scale up. If we have to start to do this, if we can't coordinate our schedules, if the two programs need to be broadcast at the same time, there isn't the bandwidth for it. And it's even worse when we go on to high definition, because to show a picture like this rather than that one requires more bits. and there won't be enough bandwidth to squeeze in an additional channel. So we'll have to start thinking of whether we're going to do that as an overlay or something like the Irish situation we saw before with two people in the studio at the same time. Things like teletext, which you won't be familiar with, it's a simple text service on television which Singapore had for many years. Technically you can still do it even on high definition, but it just looks awful. It's not really appropriate to have early 1980s graphics from PCs in the 21st century. So technically you can still do it, but it's not really appropriate. So one of the issues one needs to look at is, are we looking at ugly ducklings or are we looking at tiger cubs? That's to say, disruptive technologies, or are they going to be disruptive? New solutions, new way of doing things, and the reason why I've taken Hans Christian Andersen is that the ugly duckling, we all know, you grew into a beautiful swan. So we may have found it ugly to begin with and not particularly likable, but ultimately it grows into something we grow to like and appreciate. Whereas there may be other kinds of technologies, tiger cubs, they look really cute and cuddly, but I wouldn't like to be the foster mother of those four cubs in 6 months' time when they each weigh about 300 kilos. There would be the decided risk that if I don't get on with my foster offspring that they might actually eat me. And that's a mental picture. Some emerging technologies may look seductive, but they may have within them something which is disruptive and requires more close attention before you can actually adopt them. So we have to look at how long will the services we already have last and look at emerging solutions, trying to spot the ugly ducklings for the medium term. And certainly for digital technology, we're looking at the transition to MPEG-4, we're looking at the transition to systems which use both broadcast technologies and internet technologies, or even just look at the transition to completely internet-based technologies. So the whole point is, when do we actually switch? We have to take a decision. Are we going to do this? For example, TVB and the others have to think, are they going to start doing this in 2010? Or are they going to wait till 2012 when there's analog shutoff and start doing some of these services? Waiting 2 years would typically mean that their capital investments will be as much as 40% lower, because all things being equal, the technology is going to cost less. But on the other hand, labor costs, learning to do all these things may require a bigger running in period. So often there's a lot of challenges to decide when do we actually need to make this transition. And the other horrible thing is that we're never finished. I've talked about the transition from first to second generation, but by about the time I'm retired, we'll be thinking about a third generation. Something else will come along which we haven't even got on the drawing board right now. So what we're looking at is actually doing a fairly systematic evaluation of what are the problems, what are the causes, what are the mature solutions, what are the technologies which are out there which we can already use, and see how these fit. And we're going to do that in four countries, in Spain, Germany, Denmark and the UK. These are the partners actually helping us with that. And then what we're looking in terms of the spotting the ugly ducklings, we're going to look at a number of the new options, like these speaking interfaces, looking at replacing recordings with synthetic speech, looking at hybrid solutions, actually delivering optional services through the internet which can be combined in television sets with the original broadcast signal. And evaluating these and looking at some sort of proof of concept. Does it actually work? Does it actually make sense if we look at the whole of the value chain? And that's being done in three countries. What we can say in terms of spotting ugly ducklings, we need three success criteria. We need documented value for the users. a support for the technical solution adopted, and we need a sustainable business model. So that's why I've said, you know, a padlock and a key, but you may need a lubricant because your lock may be a little bit rusty and therefore it may need lubrication. You need all three of these metrics in place for an emerging solution to be regarded as worthwhile replacing a mature one. And so what we're currently doing is actually looking at some kind of maturity model for each service. For it, first of all, looking at each of the problems and saying how can this be addressed, and then saying what are the implications of a particular option for the different people in the value chain. So we could we're doing a lot of interviews and tests with different kinds of disability groups, just with the stuff we already have. To look at how aware are they of existence of the various services, what kinds of barriers are there even to the use of what we already have in terms of mature solutions. So the access services themselves, how are these perceived, are there areas where they could be improved? So the television programs, and then we've got this level where we're looking at the consumer electronics manufacturers, what does it take to put the technology in place? I remember a typical response is, I think it's a very good idea, but it's going to cost us too much, and we then become uncompetitive. Well, it's interesting that a television set which fully meets all of the usability requirements, all of the things I've talked about, not speech synthesis but all the other things, retails in the high streets in the UK for about £29, or what's that? It's about HK$300 or something of that kind. That's not a huge amount of money for most people. So if it's just a question of going out and buying a set-top box where they can connect to the existing TV set, $300 isn't a huge amount of money to pay to have a service that many people will be using 3 hours a day. So the price has got fairly low, and if we can actually agree on the specification for you know the minimum requirements for a set for a television receiver, if, in particular if we can do it through the International Telecommunications Union, so we've got a global entry level, then hardware manufacturers won't have the concern that they will be undercut by their competitors. The article actually mentions that well-engineered products indirectly cost retailers and broadcasters money, because there's quite a lot of evidence showing that if you have a poorly designed set, this means that the retailer gets a lot more telephone calls at their call center, and the broadcaster gets a lot more phone calls from people who are quite irate, they're angry because they can't watch television. So actually, if making sure that devices, whether it be televisions, computers or mobile phones, have a minimum of usability and accessibility makes commercial sense, because otherwise somebody else ends up paying quite a lot of money. So here we've got the users, here we've got the people who provide the devices, here we've got those who are concerned with distribution, whether this be broadcast networks or IP networks. Contribution we won't bother about, because that's a technical one, that's a sort of business-to-business communications, getting the signal out to those who are actually delivering it. But aggregation, these would be people like Now Television and your different cable or satellite operators. At the level of the TV station, they need to look at their business processes to see if they're working as effectively as they can do. Typically, access services combined add an additional cost of somewhere between 1.5% and 2% to the total production budget. If we're honest, that's peanuts. It's so small that it should be possible for any self-respecting broadcaster to find that kind of money out of their existing operating budgets. And then when it comes to producing the television program, or producing the access service, or producing the metadata to go with it, that's the information about the service, there are again areas where we can increase our efficiency and our effectiveness if we go back again to the users and take them seriously. So these are the organisations involved in the project. And just to round off, because we've only got 5 minutes or so, just to point out two other initiatives which I mentioned in the flyer for this. The first of is this strategic toolkit which the International Telecommunications Union is working on. So they're looking at overall definitions, mandates for particular governments around the world. They're also trying to document the issues in the same way as I showed you examples of exclusion before. And something about the purposes of you know, the functional and the social aspects of information and communication technologies. And this particular strategic resource guide is very ambitious. Look at the range of products it's going to be looking at. Wireless phones, PDAs, radios, television, remote controls, digital interfaces for appliances, landline phones, websites, personal computer software, electronic kiosks, broadband-based services. I think they've thought about most things, and they've got to get all that done by the end of March. So I think they've got their work cut out. But they've been working on it for nearly 8 months now. And this is a section on television which we've actually had some discussions with them about. So we can expect a toolkit, a strategic toolkit for those who are interested in engaging with the whole of the value chain for the web, for mobile, for television, for radio, for a whole host of information and communication technologies. There should be some practical suggestions on which to base policy and strategy coming out in the second quarter of next year. And there may be those of you who are not familiar with the W3C consortium. They have an accessibility initiative. So there are widely publicised web standards, not always complied with, but there are certainly very clear standards for the web for those wishing to voluntarily adopt them. And you can find them on the Web Accessibility Initiative website, which is here. What I find is interesting that they're working on areas where these various different technologies can actually benefit from each other. So there should be a completed standard for speech synthesis markup languages by sometime in the course of 2009. And speech recognition, that's to say for voice-activated controls for computers and mobiles. We already have some of these, but a more generic way of marking up speech recognition in a globally standardized way will be really great, not just to the World Wide Web, but as these are all XML-based, these have implications for all sorts of industries. So, this is the worst case scenario as far as I'm concerned. If we have the metaphor of a train and say the television is, you know, first generation is here, this is second generation, what we hope won't be taking place is that we suddenly have to stop because we haven't looked at the transition from one to the other. I hope we can actually do a better job than that. And certainly in our work in the DTV for All project, we're looking at engaging with the stakeholders in the whole of the value chain, including those the regulators and others, to actually find out what makes them tick, how they actually see this, and see if there is a consensus we can hammer out. Certainly, in the areas where there's complete agreement in the value chain, it makes sense to start there. Where there's disagreement, it may take a bit more dialogue so that people actually understand why they differ in their opinions and where we can actually establish new areas of common ground. Thank you.